You're listening to Type Radio. My name is Robert Bringhurst, and now we're talking.
Guten Abend. Jetzt gibt es Type Radio.
You're listening to Type Radio. My name is Donald.
I'm Lisa.
We're at the ATypeI conference in Dublin, Ireland in 2010, and our guest is Robert Bringhurst. Welcome.
Hello. The
first question.
Are you religious?
Probably not in the sense you mean. That is, I only go to church to look at the paintings, but I think that I have a spiritual life. Yeah.
And religious in the way you work?
Oh, you mean as in dedicated? Well, yeah, I work all the time, sure.
Do you have rituals?
No, I'm not a ritualist.
So every day would be different?
Every day is different.
But there's not one thing that you would always do every day?
Yeah, drink coffee.
I suppose you can consider that a ritual.
You could consider it a religion, yes. I have been places where there is no coffee or no coffee worth drinking, and then, I do without it. But if it's there, it will be part of my life, we all have rituals in that sense, yes, but I don't think of them as rituals. I don't look for rituals to perform. I'm not interested in ritual as such, but I'm old enough that some of my habits have been with me for a long time, and they have become ritualized just from heavy use.
But you don't need to create certain circumstances in order to perform the optimal, the best.
No, I really actively disbelieve in going about it that way. I'm not trying to recreate the same circumstances day after day, because I don't particularly want to do the same thing or get the same results day after day. But there are many things that we all do every day. Breathe, for example, right? I don't give that up, and I probably do it the same way today that I did it yesterday. But I don't think about it as a ritual.
What is your, I hope you can remember, your first typographic memory?
Really, no, because it would have come, before I was thinking about such things. But I remember becoming conscious of typography when, some other young writers and I got together and started a little publishing company. And it was only then, after we sort of set up and had a name and decided what we were going to publish in the first round, that we realized that somebody had to design the books. And as I had a little bit of architecture training, I became, by default, the book designer. I'd never thought about designing books before. I mean, I'd looked at them and thought, I like this one, I don't like that one, but I never actually thought about doing the work or how it was done. And I never thought about choosing type. And it was at that moment that I realized, that there was such a thing as choosing type. So I was in my 20s before this occurred to me. This was very late, right? I knew about something about architecture and something about painting and something about writing and something about music and nothing about typography. And I went to the library and I found Daniel Updike's book on the history of type, and this world opened to me. It was like, the heavens open and the light rains down. It was a tremendous revelation to me. It was as if, I had been looking for exactly this for half my life, and I didn't even know that I was looking for it, never mind know that it was there, that I could find it. All I had to do was go into the library, take this book off the shelf.
You didn't have any training, and then was it with this book that you?
Well, that's where it started. There are many things wrong with Updike's book, and it's quite a long ways out of date now. But it is in many ways still a wonderful book. It's still full of full of good leads, full of lovely samples, and quite a lot of still actually reliable typographic history, along with the mistakes that we all make sooner or later. But the thing is, see, I had some sense of literary history and art history. I spent a lot of time in art galleries looking at things and thinking about how writing changes from country to country and from century to century, and how painting changes also, and architecture, and you can see all these things sort of shift. It's like they're all sticks floating on the same river, and they're not, you know, perfectly in tune with each other, but they're not too far out either, and they're all going around the same bends, some of them spinning faster than others, and some of them bumping against the rocks, and some of them not, but they're all basically moving in the same current. And there didn't seem to be any sort of obvious connection between the visual art world that I knew and loved and the literary world that I knew and loved. And there it was, you see. It was in these little tiny works of art called letters, which I had been reading since I was a child and had never actually looked at carefully. But there it was. And I could see them change from the 16th century to the 17th century to the 18th century, just the way the styles of the writers changed and the music changed, the form of the string quartet or the piano sonata changed, and the paintings changed. And these little things, these letter forms, tied those two worlds together for me.
But can you say that typography is the cross-section of all your interests, that is sort of, it sort of was pinpointed into one discipline, which is typography?
Well, I haven't thought about this before, but yeah, I'd say it's quite central, sort of by accident, just because it is both visual and also tactile, and at the same time, literary. You know, I mean, literature is the art that nobody believes in, because nobody values, because you can't actually buy it and take it home and own it, right? You can own a copy of the book, but if it's a painting, you can own the thing itself, right? And you know, everybody else can have a photograph, and you've got the real thing. But you can't own the original book in that sense. You could have the manuscript, but that's just the manuscript. You could have the.
It's not the idea.
A copy of the first edition, but there are other copies of the first edition. Literature is immaterial in some sort of really resilient
sense. So would you consider that a more pure discipline in that,
no,
in that sense?
No, it's just a difference between literature and other things, and typography. But
music is the same, no? Wouldn't you compare that to music?
Yeah, that's right. Music is the same. You can't own, you know, a Mozart string quartet. You can have a copy of the score, you can have the recording, you can have the music in your head. But it's you can never sort of, you know, get it in your fist or stick it in your pocket and say, I have it and nobody else has it. It just doesn't work that way.
And the book, The Elements of Typographic Style, did you feel there was something missing and there was a necessity for this book? Is it the book you hoped you had found also in the library?
No. I only wrote the book because a publisher said, you know, you talk about type all the time and this is getting boring. Why don't you write this down and I won't have to listen to you talking about it all. And so I thought, well, yeah, sure, why not? And so we sketched out what kind of book it would be. It was going to be 128 pages long, and I sat down and wrote it on, you know, on a typewriter, basically. I mean, using a computer as a typewriter. And then I threw the manuscript away and wrote it all over again while designing it. And it turned out to be, you know, a lot more than 128 pages long.
Why did you decide to throw it away?
Well, because I had gone about it as if it were an ordinary book, you know, a novel or a novella or something where you just write the text and then you can design it, right? But that's the wrong way to write a book about type. It should grow out of the bed of the press almost, you know. I mean, I needed to show what I was talking about, and so writing about it was, well, it's a very impure book, you know. It's visual and verbal at the same time, and I had tried to approach it as if it were just verbal. Not a good idea.
Have you at any point anticipated that it would become such a style manual in the Thai world?
It was a complete surprise to me. I never thought about, you know, trying to make it popular. I just put into it what I wanted to put into it, and I suppose I put into it some of the excitement that I feel about letter forms, but it turned out that, you know, there were a whole lot of other people out there who were excited about letter forms too, and a great many of them are very intelligent people. And it seemed that, I mean, when this book first came out, quite a long time ago, it was 1992, I think, when the first edition was published, there really wasn't very much. There were the old wonderful classics, Stanley Morrison and Updike and Harry Carter and so forth, hardcore typographic history. And there were some sort of stupid teach-yourself book design books or something, but they really weren't written for kind of thinking, intelligent people. And people found that my book was one something that they were looking for. But I had no idea that this would happen.
Couldn't it also be the accessibility of, like, the way you've written about it, make it more clear, and it's more like for everybody, for a wider audience that would understand typography better?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the book's sold very well, and it's used in a lot of different places, so I guess that it must be fairly clear. But every now and again, somebody complains that it's too poetic, or it's too long, or it's too full of numerological mumbo-jumbo, or something else. But I guess if those complaints were really widespread, nobody would be buying it.
But you also keep adding things and revising.
Well, yes, of course. And I mean, people have called it a Bible, but it's nothing like the Bible because it's continually changing. It's always out of...
John Barry, by the way, was very reluctant to call it a Bible in your introduction.
Well, it's typography is a very lively field, and so the moment a new version comes off the press, it's already out of date. There are already new type designs that I wish I had included, or new type formats that I should have said something about, or something. Even new terminology, you know, because we're playing nowadays with the foundations, the mechanism of actually setting type. And so in the old days, nobody knew a typographer wouldn't have known or cared what bits and bytes were, or double bytes, or any of that. When I first wrote the book, Unicode was a sort of, you know, idea rather than a working system. These things have been growing in very interesting and productive and fruitful ways, and so I have to try to keep up.
And have you designed a typeface yourself?
No, I don't design type. I edited lots of other people's designs.
But would you like to?
Well, not especially, no. You know, I only have to be in the same room with Hermann Zapp for about 5 seconds, and it becomes perfectly obvious to me that he's the kind of person who should be designing type, and I'm the kind of person who should be talking about it. You know, Hermann has magic hands. You know, he picks up a pen, and he makes a mark with it, and it's a deep and beautiful mark. You know, I don't have those kinds of hands. So, there are plenty of type designers who actually have no graphic talent, you know, and that there are kinds of type that can be very useful that don't have to be in any way beautiful. They just have to be sort of functional, you know, like a good pickup truck. People without Hermann's talent can design types like that. People can do historical revivals without having any graphic talent. You need maybe a decent eye, and you need some kind of determination to transfer these forms from the old medium to the new medium. But that's not really type design. It's important work, but it's not, you're not really creating a new design in that case. My favorite medium is words. I think that I'm better with words than I am with a pencil. I mean, drawing with a pencil, I'm better at writing with a pencil. So that's what I do.
For your poems, do you also dictate what typeface they would be set in, or that?
Well, I usually do design my own books, whatever book they are, just in self-defense, because if I don't do it, somebody else will, and that somebody else may not be a very good typographer. but I have lots of friends who are superb typographers, and if one of them is going to design it instead, that's fine. I'm entirely happy to turn it over to them, and walk away and do something else. But if I just give it to a publisher who's just going to hire somebody who doesn't cost too much money to do the book, and the guy's going to do the book, you know, as quickly as he can because he wants to get on to the next job because he wants to make some money, this is not an attractive arrangement to me. But I published books where I had very little design control. This new selected poems that just came out from Jonathan Cape is part of a series. All the books are set in the same typeface. The arrangement is always centered, basically. The titles are always in oversized capitals. The margins are tiny. The paper is cheap. They're of a fixed size. The maximum length is 160 pages. And so, you know, a great many design decisions have been already made there. So there wasn't very much I could do. I could jump up and down and say, you left out the ligatures. Put the ligatures in. Okay. Or, you know, get rid of that terrible Greek typeface here. I'll set the Greek for you, and you can just, you know, sort of scan it and paste it in. But I have no control over what 99% of it looks like.
Aren't you disappointed with that, or?
Well, no, actually, because for what it is, the format is all right. I mean, it's a good type. They set all these poetry books in Bembo, very good type of type. I might have chosen it on its own merits. I mean, I think that there's nothing wrong with producing series of books. The wonderful Gallimard Pléiade series, in which all the classics of French literature are published in the same typeface, on the same paper, in the same binding. I mean, it's good that this is not the only kind of book we have, but there's no reason why books like that shouldn't exist. I have nothing against being part of such a series. But it's not exciting to do the design in that case. It's already done. I mean, I don't want my own books to be typographically self-conscious, particularly. I just want them to be, you know, comfortable to handle and easy to read.
The typography should be serving the text.
Yeah, sure.
You've done a lot of research on Native American languages. Where does that fascination come from?
Well, I'm a Native American myself. That is, you know, I was born in North America. I lived there. If you wander around Europe, you see things from a former time. You see old buildings in the cities. You see old cottages in the countryside. You can visit archaeological sites where old stone tools and ancient pots and so forth are found. And there's nothing preventing you feeling some kind of connection with these historical sites. But in North America, people are taught implicitly from childhood, usually, that there is no connection between them and anything in the land that's old. I think this is a stupid way to live. It's as if the landscape was something that you bought in a grocery store and put in the refrigerator, and when you want something, some of it you open the can and take some out. It makes it impossible to live in a really human way. And it encourages people not to take care of the land. Well, the only problem here is that the educational system is messed up. Right? The educational system is still founded on the idea that real human beings came to America from Europe and they brought their languages and their books and their styles of architecture and everything else with them, and that's the only tradition that matters. And that intellectually, North Americans tend to turn their backs on native societies because initially they got there by trespassing on other people's land, and the easiest way to deal with that was to pretend that the other people weren't there. You just ignore them, and maybe they'll go away or die or something. So I don't want to live like that. Well, I just happen to enjoy playing with languages. So my way of getting back in touch with the real cultural history of the country that I was born in is by studying these languages and then reading what there is to read in them. There's a great deal to read.
There is, because that sort of surprises me.
This is a fairly well-kept secret for some reason. these were oral cultures, right? They didn't have north of the Rio Grande and north of Mexico. There were no writing systems until after the Europeans came, and then some indigenous ones were developed after people had seen European writing. But there was no indigenous writing north of Mexico. But there was, you know, every culture has a language, and every language has a literature. There are always people telling stories, singing songs, making poems. The stories can be huge, and they can be immensely complex. And it can be a lifetime job to learn these stories and tell them. When linguists began studying these languages, and that started in Mexico in the 15th century, at the end of the 15th century, and farther north later, in the late 18th, early 19th century. When linguists started studying these languages, they were any good, they did it by getting people to tell them stories, and they wrote them down. Well, you know, there are thousands and thousands of pages of these transcripts in more than 100 Native American languages. And some of them have been edited and translated, and many of them have not. Some of them have been published, typeset somehow, and printed. Many others have not. They're just, the manuscripts are sitting there waiting for someone to do the work. Mm. So there's this enormous body of literature in well over 100 languages. Nobody tells university students that this exists, and so they don't know that there's all this work to do. It's very satisfying work. It's a lot more fun to work on something that's been sitting there ignored for 100 years than to write another study of somebody's study of Shakespeare, for example. There's a great deal, the learning curve is much steeper there, and the rewards are greater. You're not fighting the history of accumulated criticism, but actually getting back in touch with a real world, a tradition of indigenous wisdom, great knowledge of plants and animals and the weather and the rivers and the mountains and these beautiful, beautiful stories.
And it's even more now in these days, these times, it's more necessary to get in touch more with that wisdom, you could say.
It is, because these stories come out of societies that knew how to live on the land for thousands of years without destroying it. Well, you know, modern industrial civilization clearly doesn't know how to do that.
It's so detached from the source, you could say.
It's also obsessed with its own notions of progress and competition. We actually live in a society that is willing to destroy the earth in order to keep ahead of the neighbors. You know, this is insane.
Does this relates to your talk? One ignores, for example, Latinizing a Greek typeface?
Yes.
Would you consider that evolution, though, or just ignorance?
Ignorance.
Yeah.
It's called progress, but it's actually the reverse of progress. You know, moving forward and forgetting the past, leaving the past behind, is not progress. That's just stupidity. If you don't learn anything, you might as well not live. Of course, things always get lost. You can't save everything, and you would suffocate if you did. But you can't throw everything away either, because if you do, you won't know how to live your life.
But don't you think now it's even easier to save quite a lot? I mean, with all this new technology and scanning and saving and...
Well, that doesn't necessarily constitute saving. If I scan a book and put it on my computer, I'm no wiser than I was before. Right? I haven't learned a thing. All I've done is rearrange some electrons on a on a hard drive. And if I actually study this book or learn the language that it was written or spoken in, then it will change me. Then something actually happens. It's like eating dinner instead of, you know, just reading the menu, or taking the menu and scanning it and putting it in your menu collection. You can't derive any nourishment by doing this.
Information is still there. You wouldn't say it's lost. If there was somebody else that was searching for it, there was still a chance to still find it, as opposed to...
Well, information is never complete in itself. You know, it always needs a context in order to be what it can be. The paintings in the National Gallery of Ireland here are very well cared for. They're clean and nice and well insured and hung securely on the wall so they don't fall down and break. There are little ropes to keep people from getting too close and breathing on them or touching them with their oily fingers. So they're saved. But if we don't remember the stories that are in the paintings, if we don't remember anything about the history of the societies in which these paintings were made, then they kind of dry up like old fruit or something. They just shrivel up and blow away. You need a living society in order for things like that to really function. And it's the same with books, with letters. We could have 100,000 different typefaces, but if nobody did anything with them except play with them, nobody wrote anything in them, nobody read what was written, nobody paid attention to what they read, nobody thought about it, it would all be a complete waste. The Native American literature is full of subtle allusions and references to things in the landscape, to ideas, to places, to people, to other stories, to mythological characters, and if you don't have that cloud of background knowledge, the texts are impenetrable. It would be like trying to read an ancient Greek story and having no idea who Athena or Zeus or Poseidon are. Or going to the art gallery and looking at a painting of the crucifixion and having no knowledge of this story, not knowing who is this guy hanging on this cross, what is this? If you lose the background knowledge, then you just have a piece of design. Well, design is all very nice, but it isn't enough all by itself. There's no protein there. Mm-hmm. So, sure, it's nice that we have ways of saving. If we had no writing, then when the linguists went in to listen to the old people tell stories, they would not have been able to write them down. Well, now we have the tape recorder, and so people mostly don't write them down anymore. They just go in there with their tape recorder, they record the stories, they put their tapes in an archive somewhere. That's not enough. There's work to do transcribing those tapes, putting them in a form that people can read, can study, can take apart, put back together again, and making sure we have enough background knowledge to understand them. So the saving part is actually, there's a lot of work involved. There's a lot of work to do in the margins and in the foundations to keep that stuff alive.
But for example, the Odyssey or the Iliad, they were always spoken. The minutes they were written down, do you think then they stopped by passing on a story like that? It always evolves. Mm. Then that also changes the way that poem developed.
It does. But you see, no one really speaks ancient Greek anymore. And so the best we can do with these stories now is recite them, listen to them, read them. In ancient Greek, literary evolution has stopped. Well, it's stopped in a lot of Native American languages too, because the oral tradition basically is ended. I mean, people might still talk, they might still tell little stories, but they don't tell the great big stories because they're now living in a world with television and telephones and printed books and schools, and that really gets in the way of the oral tradition. And many of the languages are not spoken at all anymore. They're as dead as Latin or classical Greek. Still, there are these treasures that were saved. So evolution now stops within that language, but it doesn't mean that it stops altogether. It's going to leap into another language, that's all. So the Iliad and the Odyssey are still very active forces literarily, but their effects are now to be found in English and French and German and Dutch and Spanish and Italian and all the languages that are used by writers who are reading the old book or modern Greek.
The last question? How would you like to be remembered?
Gee, I don't know if I'd like to be remembered at all.
Well, at least within the type world, you'll be remembered.
Well, no, you see, I mean, this book, I mean, I'm very glad that this book is useful to people, but as we were saying earlier, it goes constantly out of date, and when I'm no longer around to keep it up to date, it will, you know, sort of fade away.
But don't you think like...
But this isn't like the Iliad, it isn't some timeless work, it's a practical tool and a celebration, it's like a party, it's sooner or later it ends, then... It's over, that's all. Other things that I've written may last longer because they're not...
Your poetry, for instance.
Well, it may, but there's no way of knowing. Mm. All right.
Thank you very much. Well,
Thank you.
Guten Abend. Jetzt gibt es Type Radio.